So we're very happy to have Andrea Mitridate today from Caltech, and Andrea is going to tell us how we can use pulsar timing arrays to learn about the dark matter power spectrum. Please take it away, Andrea.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm happy to talk about this work that I've recently done together with Vincent Lee, Tanner Trickle, and Catherine Zurek here at Caltech. So I try to keep the presentation short so there is time for questions. So if you have any questions during the talk or something it's not clear, please just stop me, and I'm happy to try to answer. Okay, so let's just get started. So I don't think I have to spend much time convincing you about the importance that dark matter plays in the formation of structure. So we know that primordial perturbation in the dark matter density field seed the structures that we see today in the universe. And we have actually measured these primordial perturbations on large scale indirectly through the CMB. And by large scale, I mean scales larger than the megaparsec, moving scales larger than the megaparsec. And we know that on this large scale, these primordial perturbations are roughly scale invariant. And we also have a very tight constraint on their amplitude. However, as you can see in this plot, on smaller scale, we essentially have no observation and no constraint on the amount of perturbations on smaller scales. And gaining access to these small scales can actually be crucial in pinning down the correct model of dark matter. Indeed, several models for dark matter predict a different amount of perturbations on this small scale. Like, for example, in this slide, I'm showing the dimensionless power spectrum at the end of recombination, which is predicted by some benchmark model that I will consider later on. Like in the left panel, you can see the primordial power spectrum for axion mini clusters, which are expected to be produced in axion models where the Peccei-Quinn symmetry is broken after inflation. And you can see that compared to lambda CDM, which is the white line, the amount of structures, I mean, the amount of perturbations that you expect on this small scale is orders of magnitude larger. And the same thing happened, as you can see in the right panel, in models where you have an early stage of matter domination or in models of vector dark matter produced during inflation. So all these models predict much more perturbations at small scale. And so gaining access to this small scale can really tell you whether or not these models are a good candidate for dark matter. So the question now is how we can gain access to this small scale. So these small scales today will correspond to subgalactic scale. So you really want to have a probe that allows you to measure dark matter substructures within the Milky Way. And there have been several proposals. Some of them relies on gravitational lensing, others on indirect detection-like techniques. And today I will discuss another possibility, which if you want, it's similar to gravitational lensing in the sense that relies uniquely on the gravitational interactions of dark matter. So you don't need to specify the interactions of dark matter with the standard model, but you just care about the gravitational interactions. And the mechanism is based on pulsar timing. So let me just give you some general information about pulsars, and then we will see how a local population of dark matter sub-halos can be observed in pulsar timing. And then later on, I will discuss how we can relate the primordial power density of dark matter fluctuations to a local population of dark matter sub-halos. So, what are pulsars? So, pulsars are neutron stars which are highly magnetized and rotating with a rotation period which is highly stable, especially for millisecond pulsars, which will be the main subject of this talk. And in addition to this, these neutron stars emit a lot of electromagnetic radiations out of their magnetic poles. And this is essentially the way in which you observe them. And as of now, the largest catalog of millisecond pulsars that you have is provided by the NanoGraph collaboration, which is able to observe a little less than 50 of them, all within a radius of 5 kiloparsec from the solar system. But in the near future, experiments like SKA will bring this number up to order of hundreds or thousands. So there is room for improvement in this regard. But now the question is how we can use them as a detector for dark matter substructions. And the key property that we're going to exploit is the fact that the magnetic axis of this pulsar is generally not aligned with the rotation axis. So as the pulsar rotates, the electromagnetic beam, which is emitted by the magnetic poles, changes direction in the sky, and this can bring the beam to swipe across the location of the Earth. So if this happened to us, observer on the Earth, the pulsar will appear as a periodic emitter. And because of the very stable rotation period, this pulse of radiation will arrive separated by a very stable time interval. So the frequency at which we receive these radiation pulses is very well described by this timing model, where you have a constant piece, which is essentially of order of 1/milliseconds, so kilohertz, and then you have a small time variation of the frequency. And by small, I mean that this nu zero dot over nu zero is of order 10^-23, 10^-20 hertz. And then you also have a quadratic piece, which is even smaller. And essentially, we will neglect this quadratic piece in the following. So for us, the frequency at which we receive these pulses is described by this timing model. And of course, there can be some fluctuations around this model, but the key point is that these fluctuations do not accumulate in time. So if we look at the integrated phase, we can kind of average this fluctuation out. And so really the key quantity that you're going to look at is this integrated phase. It's nothing more than the integral of this timing model. So again, the key point here is that the pulses that we receive from the pulsar, we expect to be described by this timing model. So we get the data, we fit for this parameter, nu zero and nu dot zero. And once we have fit for this parameter, we expect all the sequent pools of radiation to follow this model. Okay, but now we can ask and consider the case where you have a dark matter halo which transit by close to the pulsar. So this dark matter halo will exert a gravitational pull on the pulsar, which will accelerate towards the halo. And this acceleration will induce a Doppler shift of the pulses that we receive from the pulsar. And this shift is not described, it's not well described by the timing model that I just showed you in the previous slide. So if you now try to fit the time of arrival of the pulses to the timing model, you will find a large timing residual. And this large timing residual is the dark matter signal that you are looking at. So we are looking for a large timing residual, which is telling you that there is something going on near the pulsar. The pulsar is accelerating, and this is inducing a large timing residual. Now, in reality, the situation is a bit more complicated because we don't have a single pulsar. So we have an array of pulsars. So we are looking at multiple pulsars in the sky, and each of them we expect to be surrounded by a population of dark matter subhalos. And each of them will induce a phase shift. So the total phase shift is given by the sum. So you have an index I, which identifies the pulsar, and the phase shift of this pulsar is given by the sum of the phase shift induced by each of the subhalos which surrounds it. So everything is linear, so you can just sum the phase shift. And if there are dark matter subhalos, again, you will expect a large timing residual. Okay, so far we have
discussed. Can I ask a silly question here?
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to understand exactly what it is in the, so the model that the people had, you said, was quadratic in time. In the previous slide, you said something like nu of time was quadratic in time. What is the, so when you say that what you're measuring here is basically the acceleration of this thing, right?
Yeah.
And over the times you watch it, why isn't that quadratic in time, for example? Why I'm just thinking that if I had a acceleration that was slowly growing.
Yeah, because the dark matter halo is not static. Okay, you have a dark matter halo which transit by, so you will have your signal will look like a pulse. You will have a pulse in the acceleration. So that if the dark matter halo was static, was not moving, so you had the dark matter halo sitting by the pulsar, you would have an acceleration which will be degenerate with the timing model. So you're right. You will not be able to measure that because the acceleration induced by the pulsar will be degenerate with the timing model because the
the idea is that the dark matter position is changing sufficiently quickly that you'll be able to resolve this in the times with the precision you have in the times that you have. That's okay. That's
yeah. The more static is the dark matter halo, the hardest is to disentangle the dark matter signal from the timing model.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Yeah, and this is we are looking at an acceleration of the pulsar, but the same kind of effect you will get by accelerating the Earth. So we expect also the Earth to be surrounded by a population of dark matter halos, and this population of dark matter halos can induce an acceleration of the Earth. And an acceleration of the observer will induce a Doppler shift in the same way that you get by accelerating the source. The only conceptual difference in accelerating the observer is that we'll induce a signal which is coherent among all the pulsar in the array. So if you accelerate the observer, that will generate a signal in all the pulsar in the array, and this signal is expected to be, these signals are expected to be correlated. So these are really the two kind of signal that we will consider, an acceleration of the pulsar and an acceleration of the Earth. Both induce a phase shift. The first one is uncorrelated among the pulsars. The second one is correlated among the pulsars. But the conceptual source of the signal is the same.
Yeah, may I ask you something? So perhaps you will come to that later, but what are characteristic numbers here? So what is the mass of these halos that you will be considering and the distances? Because I'm just wondering, there are other accelerations which may be hard to account, for example, due to some asteroids or stars, this kind of things.
I'm trying to be, for the moment, agnostic on the properties of this halo population. And later on, I will connect the properties of this population of dark matter halos to the primordial power of dark matter density fluctuation. So depending on what is your primordial power of density fluctuations, you will have a different mass for these halos, a different concentration for these halos. And of course, the signal that you expect will change according to that.
Yeah, but what about the generation with stars? Yeah, so for example, I can think about some stars passing by that's pulsar and also producing acceleration. So
yeah, but we expect the density of this object to be much, much, much larger than stars. We are looking at much, much lighter objects than the stars. So the density of these ones is much larger. So the probability to have one of these objects to pass close enough to the pulsar to generate a signal to be much larger compared to the probability of having a star passing by a pulsar.
But if they are much lighter, then I'll have some asteroids, which we don't know anything about. So
I think for at least for the benchmark model that we will look at, we will live in this intermediate region where you have lighter than stars but heavier than asteroids.
I understand. Thank you.
Yeah. But you're right. In general.
Sure. Just to follow up on that, the thing is that we know that we see these things in orbits around things, right? So even though the stars are heavier, why aren't the pulsars? How do you know the pulsars are not preferentially in areas like in globular clusters or something where there is a lot of stars more than that? I guess you're looking at ones that are close to us. I guess is that the?
Yeah. So all the millisecond pulsars that we are looking at are within five kiloparsec from the solar system. So we are really looking and probing the local population of dark matter survey. We are not looking to extragalactic sources for this analysis. But yeah, again, the signal will depend on the mass and the characteristic of this dark matter survey population, and we will discuss this in a moment. So up to now, I described this shift in terms of the gravitational potential of the dark matter halo. But if you specify the density profile of the halos, you can actually derive this phase shift analytically. So for example, if you assume that the halos have an NFW profile, which is, it's kind of general. Even if you start with a known NFW profile, you can see that the merger history tends to drive the density profile to an NFW one. So this is kind of general approximation. So if you make this approximation, you can derive the phase shift analytically, and you get this expression for the phase shift, but where you have the mass of the halo, which is defined as the mass contained within the virial radius. Then you have a form factor, which takes into account that these halos are not point-like, so they are fluffy objects. So and the concentration, the compactness of these objects is parameterized in terms of this concentration parameter C, which is defined as the ratio of the virial radius over the scalar radius. And then you have X, which is just a normalized time variable. It's not important to understand all the details of this equation. Just keep in mind that you can derive an analytic form for the phase shift, and this analytic form is what we will use in the code to compute the signal. Okay, so we have seen the kind of shift or timing residual that we expect to be produced by a population of dark matter sub-halos. Now we have to ask if this phase shift and this timing residual is large enough to be detected over the background. And the background is present because even if you don't have dark matter halos, you will always have some timing residual, just because the fitting procedure to the timing model cannot be perfect. And this noise we assume to be white and stationary, so that it's fully characterized by its two-point function. And now we ask how large the dark matter signal HI needs to be compared to the noise for us to detect it.
So so you're assuming that the timing noise for each pulsar is white. Is there a reason for this? Why?
At this point, it's just for simplicity. Catherine with his student Vincent are looking for a more realistic study of the noise, including the red noise.
Nanograph actually has direct measurements of this, right?
Sorry, I missed that.
Well, these experiments like Nanograph presumably by now must have direct measurements of the timing noise.
They have. So in this analysis, we didn't include a full and realistic characterization of the noise. We were more concerned in developing a pipeline to go from a primordial power to a dark matter signal. But Catherine with Vincent are actually working together with the Nanograph collaboration to include a realistic characterization of the noise. So in the near future, we should be able to tell how much a realistic characterization of the noise will impact the results that I show you. But yeah, totally. This is a simplification. In general, the noise, it's not purely white. This is just to simplify the analysis, yeah.
But your signal that you're looking for isn't just the excess fluctuations. You're looking for some actual template in the timing residual.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's why your assumption about the noise isn't so important. Is that the idea?
But the thing, a fully characterization of the noise, I agree, could could impact the results by a factor of a few. So yeah, that's something that we are definitely working on.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, okay, so allies needs the dark matter signal to be in. Naively, you would say that the amplitude of the signal needs to be larger than the amplitude of the noise. But you would soon realize that we can actually do better than this because we know something about the signal that we are looking for. We know something about the shape of the signal that we expect to see in the data. So you can actually filter the data to filter out the noise and just keep the signal. I mean, this is called a matching filter procedure. And the optimal scenario in which you can live is the one in which you know exactly the signal that you're looking for. If you know exactly the signal that you're looking for, you can filter the data with the signal itself. And if you do that, you see that the signal part of the data grows linearly with time, while the noise part of the data grows only quadratically. So as you increase the observation time, the significance of the signal over the noise grows with the square root of t. So you can see that filtering the data, you can actually gain quite a lot in the significance of the signal over the background. Now, of course, this is an ideal scenario in which you know precisely the signal. In general, you don't know precisely the signal. But if the signal shape is simple enough, you can parameterize it. So you can have a grid of filters that you can apply to the data. And if the grid is fine enough, among all the filters that you apply to the data, one of them will get close enough to the optimal filter. So you can hope that among all the filters, one is close enough and the signal to noise ratio, the larger signal to noise ratio that you get is close to the optimal one. And this is the case for the pulsar term. For the pulsar term, the typical signal shape is simple enough that you can parameterize it with a relatively small number of parameters. So you can hope that you can recover the optimal filter. So the expected SNR scales like the signal square. The same thing cannot be done for the Earth signal. So the Earth signal is dominated by a multitude of halos. So the signal shape, as you can see, is not as simple as for the pulsar term. So you cannot hope to recover the optimal filter. So instead of looking at the signal itself, we look at the two-point function of the signal. And we filter this two-point function with its expectation value, which can be,
So yeah. I'm not sure I understand. So why the Earth signal is dominated by multiple events as a contrast to pulsar signal?
I was a bit too fast. So you don't expect the pulsar signal in each pulsar to be dominated by a single event, but you expect, and we have checked this, that the largest signal in the array is dominated by a single event because you have a bunch of pulsars that you're looking at. So the probability to have a very close transit to one of them is large, and that will dominate the signal across the array. While for the Earth, you have only one sample, which is you have only one Earth. And in this case, generally, you don't have a very close transiting object. So there is not a large hierarchy between the closest transiting object and all the other ones, so that the full signal is dominated by multiple dark matter surveillance.
I see. But for Earth signal, you can correlate different pulses on the other hand, yeah?
So you gain on that, and you can see this because you can see that the Earth term scales quadratically with the number of pulsars. And this is exactly because the signal is correlated among pulsars.
Okay, good.
So this is a bit subtle, but yeah. You don't expect the signal in each pulsar to be dominated by a single event. You only expect the largest signal across the pulsar array to be dominated by a single event.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, it's true, especially if you have a large number of pulsars in the array.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, so these are the expected value for the signal to noise ratio for the pulsar and the Earth term that we are going to use. So in general, how we actually compute the signal to noise ratio? So we have a Monte Carlo code that takes as input these quantities, so the spatial and velocity distribution for the dark matter halos. And this is in general model independent. So we expect that locally, the spatial distribution is homogeneous and the velocity is a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. This is kind of model independent. Then you have model dependent quantities, which depends on the specific dark matter models, which are the mass distribution of the halos and their concentration parameter. So these are model-dependent quantities, but once you give this as an input, the code generates a population of dark matter halos, and from this generates the timing residual that they produce in each pulsar in the array. And now we are going to discuss actually how to derive these model-dependent quantities, starting from the primordial density perturbations of the dark matter. And yeah, just before moving on, I'll just tell that the code is publicly available on GitHub, so you can take the code, specify whatever dark matter population you like, and the code will tell you what is the expected signal to noise ratio that you're going to see in a pulsar timing experiment. Okay, so let's now go from early universe to present days. So we will start by parameterizing the primordial power of density fluctuations of the dark matter as a scale invariant piece, which is the standard one that you have in Lambda CDM, and then a model dependent piece, which will be specific to the dark matter model. And this is the primordial power that you get at the end of inflation. Then you have to evolve this primordial power until today. And this evolution is usually break down in two pieces. A first evolution, which goes from the end of inflation to the end of recombination. And this is described by the transfer function T. And then you have all the following evolution from the end of recombination until today. And this is described by the growth function D. And look that we are allowing for a different transfer and growth function for the scale invariant term and the model dependent term. And also notice that the transfer function that we consider for the scale invariant term doesn't need to be the standard one that you have in Lambda CDM. Can also be a different transfer function so that you can have deviations from Lambda CDM either by having a non-zero model-dependent piece in the primordial power, but also by having a non-standard growth of the standard scale invariant primordial power spectrum. And like this is the plot that I show you in the introduction. Like for axiom mini clusters, this peak is given by a peak in the primordial power. So at the end of inflation, axiom mini cluster have this peak in the power spectrum, but like in models of early matter domination, the power at the end of inflation is the one of Lambda CDM, and this peak is induced by a different evolution of these perturbations, so a different transfer function. So in general, you can have these two kind of effects that generate a peak in the power spectrum, either a different power of perturbations at the end of inflation or a different evolution of the Lambda CDM perturbations. Okay, so far we have talked about the power spectrum, but we know that the power spectrum just describes linear perturbations. And these linear perturbations, as the universe expands, will grow and grow. And at some point, they will gravitationally collapse, forming dark matter halos. Okay, and the population of these dark matter halos in the universe, their number density is described by the halo mass function. It gives you the number density per logarithmic mass interval. But then if you zoom within this halo, you will notice that these halos contains other sub-halos. So you have a hierarchy of structures. So, and this hierarchy is really what we want to probe. We want to probe the dark matter sub-halos within the big halos of the Milky Way. So we need to derive, starting from the dark matter density fluctuations, the halo mass function, and the sub-halo mass function. And I mean, this in general, it's a highly nonlinear problem, and you need, I mean, numerical simulations to solve. However, there have been developed analytic approximations that allows you to go from these linear perturbations to the matter in a mass function. And one of the most famous is the one developed by Press Schechter. So the idea of the Press Schechter formal is that this dark matter density fluctuations will collapse and detach from the Hubble form when the overdensities cross a critical value. So you really need to ask, what is the probability that a region of a given size will reach an overdensity which is larger than this critical value? And this probability for a patch in the universe of a given mass, I mean, the mass is related by the size by this equation, at a given redshift is given by this equation. But you see that you have an exponential which contains the overdensity and the variance of the dark matter density fluctuations smooth over a region of size R. And you see that this variance contains the fundamental quantity that you are looking at, which is the power spectra of dark matter density fluctuations. So once you have this probability, you can actually compute the halo mass function within the Press Schechter formalism. And this is what you get. So this is really an analytic prescription to solve what will be an highly nonlinear problem. And this formalism has been validated for lambda CDM. You see that this analytic prescription, once you tune the free parameters like the critical value of the overdensities, reproduce the numerical result to a quite good level of accuracy. Of course, you could ask if the same is true for models which have a much larger power of density fluctuations of small scales, like the one that we are studying. And this will require a check against numerical simulations, which, however, it's not possible for all the models because numerical simulations haven't been done for all the dark matter models that we are considering. The only one which actually has some numerical results is the Axiom Mini Cluster model. So for these models, we have actually checked that the numerical results, which are the green dot, agrees quite well with the Press Schechter results, which are the blue dot, up to high masses where essentially the numerical simulations start to lose sensitivity. So you can see that the agreement is quite good, definitely good enough given the systematic that we have in our analysis. And so this gives us some level of confidence that the Press Schechter formalism is a good description also for the other models that we are going to consider. And this is what we are going to use to relate the primordial density fluctuations to the halo mass function.
Do you know what's happening at high masses? It's I mean, the kink is kind of funky.
Yeah, I think that the simulations are starting to lose sensitivity just because the mass of the halos is starting to approach the mass of the box that they are considering.
Oh, I see. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, and the same thing. So far, I have shown you how to derive the halo mass function. But within the Press Schechter formalism, you can similarly derive also the sub-halo mass function. So the distribution of sub-halos within a larger halo. And I mean, it's given by this equation for the Milky Way. So this is the mass of the Milky Way. And notice that I'm writing this Sabelo mass function in terms of the accretion mass. So the accretion mass is the mass of the Sabelos when they enter the larger host halo. And I'm specifying this because in general, the mass of the halo will be affected by tidal effects once they are, I mean, once they enter the big host halo. So the final mass is going to be changed by tidal effects. So in general, you will have that. So there are several tidal effects that you can consider. And the largest one, and the one that we will consider, is the one which is induced by the gravitational pull of the host halo on the sub-halo. And so consider to have a sub-halo on a circular orbit. So you will have a gravitational pull from the host, and this gravitational pull can be stronger than the gravitational attraction that keeps the sub-halo together. So you can find a tidal radius which tells you what is the distance from the sub-halo center beyond which the gravitational pull from the host halo becomes stronger than the gravitational pull that keeps the sub-halo together. And this tidal radius can be found analytically and is given by this equation. So the simplest approximation that you can make is to say that all the mass of the sub-halo which is outside the tidal radius will be stripped away in the orbit during the motion of the sub-halos within the host. So that the final distribution, the final mass distribution of the sub-halos will be affected by these tidal effects. And of course, this is just one of the tidal effects that sub-halos will experience within a host galaxy. In general, you will have other tidal effects like interactions between sub-halos and stuff like that. But as we will see, already these tidal effects only is enough to make standard lambda CDM sub-halos too rare to be observed in pulsar timing. So we don't really need to include additional tidal effects because just this is enough to make certain kind of models undetectable by pulsar timing. And and here is where the real difference between lambda CDM and the other models arise, because the amount of disruption that you experience because of tidal effects depends on the concentration of the sub-halos. The denser is the sub-halo, the less it will be affected by these tidal effects. And the concentration of the sub-halo, so the scale density of the sub-halo, is determined by the density of the universe at the time of collapse. So the early on the collapse of the halo happens, the denser will be this object. And the time of collapse of the halo, you can gain some intuition about when a halo will collapse just by comparing the variance of density fluctuations versus the critical density. So when the variance on a given scale gets of the same order of the critical density, the halos will start to collapse. So the larger is the amount of fluctuations that you have on a given scale, the early on these halos will collapse. And the early on these halos collapse, the larger will be their density, and so the less will be the impact of tidal effects. And you can see this from this plot where I'm plotting the mass distribution of sub-halos for two different models. So standard lambda CDM and models with an early stage of matter domination. And you can see how much tidal effects deplete the amount of standard lambda CDM Sabelo. So the solid line is the distribution of dark matter Sabelos before the inclusions of tidal effects. And the dotted line is after the inclusion of tidal effects. So there is a depletion of more than one order of magnitude. And this is because the typical concentration of these Sabelos it's quite low. However, if you look at the model with an early stage of matter domination, you will notice that this low mass Sabelo, which collapse very early on in the universe, have a much larger concentration parameter. And this larger concentration parameter is such that these halos are much less affected by the tidal effects. So even if the large mass tail, where the halos are similar to the one of standard lambda CDM, are highly depleted, this peak at low masses survives. And this, as we will see in a moment, allows this model to be within the reach of full surtiming arrays, while standard lambda CDM Sabelos essentially cannot be detected just because they are so highly depleted by tidal effects.
So are these the masses you'll be focusing on, like 10 to the minus 9 solar masses or so?
Yeah, this is a specific model. Like for models with an early stage of matter domination, depending on the temperature at which you have this early matter domination, you can have mass as low as 10 to the minus 9.
So you are focusing on these like asteroid kind of masses, okay. So if you translate these masses and concentrations into like a scale radius for the NFW profile, what sort of values will this correspond to?
I'm not sure I can make the translation on the fly. I don't want to say something wrong.
Okay, sure.
I should check, yeah. So let's look at some benchmark model. So the first one is lambda CDM. And as I just told you, the effect of this tidal disruption is so strong that you don't have sensitivity. So here I'm showing the sigma significance of the signal to noise ratio that would be generated by lambda CDM Sabelos for different values of pulsars in the array and observation time. And you can see that it's low, whatever values you choose for these parameters, just because these objects are so rare that they don't give a strong enough signal. However, the story changes quite a bit if you look to, for example, axiom mini clusters. So in axiom models where the Pecheki symmetry is broken after inflation, you expect to form these axiom mini clusters. And the density of these objects is very high compared to lambda CDM Sabelos. And because of this, they will survive a fraction of them to tidal disruption. And you see that you start to see a signal which has, a reasonably high sigma significance. So this is still, this is going to be still out of reach at the beginning for SKA, because in the first years of operation, I think they don't plan to see more than thousands of pulsars. So I would say that SKA will see something around here. So they are not within reach quite yet, but they are fairly close. They're fairly close. And the same is true for models with an early stage of matter domination. So in this model, before recombination, you have an early stage of matter domination, and the modes which are within the horizon during this early stage of matter domination are going to grow linearly with the scale factor instead of logarithmically. And this will induce a peak in the power spectrum. And this peak will induce a larger amount of structures at these small scales. And again, these Sabelos, as we have seen quite some time at this point, I have a large concentration parameter, so they can survive. And as you can see, also for this model, the sigma significance starts to be quite strong. Again, the reach for SKA, SKA will be slightly out of reach, at least for an observation time of 20 years, but slightly more futuristic. PTA parameters are going to be enough to probe models of this kind.
So is this five sigma coming from like many, many pulsars that have like one sigma detections? Or instead, is this coming from like one pulsar that has like a five sigma event?
So in the low mass region, the signal is dominated by the Earth term. So the signal in the Earth term is correlated among the pulsars. So you expect to have, the signal is correlated. So you expect the signal to be of the same order in all the pulsars in the array. It's not dominated by the pulsar signal where you have a hierarchy of different signal to noise ratio in different pulsars. I don't know if this answered the question.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
And finally, there are models of vector dark matter produced during inflation. Here you have a peak, and the location of the peak in the primordial power, depends on the mass of the dark matter. But you can see that if you go to line up dark matter, you start to have sensitivity. So vector dark matter produced during inflation with a low enough mass can give you a signal. Okay, I think this is cool. So just to summarize, we provide a pipeline to go from primordial perturbations in the dark matter density field to a signal in pulsar timing arrays. And we have used this pipeline to compute the signal that we expect from lambda CDM dark matter surveillos. And we have seen that because of tidal effects, the signal is too low to be detected. But for models which have an enhanced amount of power on small scales, dark matter surveillos can survive tidal effects. And this allows the models to be within reach of future pulsar timing arrays experiment. And finally, we make this pipeline in the Monte Carlo that we use to generate this signal public so that if you have your dark matter model and you know what is the population of dark matter surveillance that you expect, you can just use this Monte Carlo to compute the pulsar timing array signal that your model is going to generate and see if that can be tested. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Are there any more questions from the audience?
I thought that the vectors from inflationary perturbations, they were okay down to like 10 to the minus 5 eV. And for like ultralight stuff, there's no inflation scale that gives you the right thingy. Is that right?
Sorry, 10 to the minus?
5 electron volts. That's GeV, sorry. You can see the GeV. So that's...
That is sure. I was also confused, yeah. But still it's a bit low, right?
It's a bit, it's still borderline.
It's quite low. Yeah, it starts to be intentional with... I mean, there is a relation between the scale of inflation that you need and the mass of the dark matter. And we are... Yeah. I mean, the values that can be probed need a scale of inflation that starts to be intentional with experimental data. Yeah, you're right.
Right.
So that's a good catch.
But you need somehow, like, you need these guys to be very, very light so that the peak in the power spectrum is in the right place. But what do you need, like, so you need the peak on the power spectrum to be low so that the subhalos are small mass, like 10 to the minus 9 solar masses or something. Why do you need those small masses? Why is that important? Why can't you see these? If you had a subhalo of, say, one solar mass, why can't you see that?
No, but actually notice that when you go to higher masses, the peak of the power spectrums moves to lower masses.
Yeah.
So notice that here, as you increase the dark matter mass, the peak moves to lower masses. So you produce lighter and lighter dark matter halos. So at some point we lose sensitivity.
Oh, so you go the other way
around. So this is
okay.
Yeah. So this is why we need
lower
dark matter masses.
But okay, that's for the dark photon thingy. But for the rest of the signals, I mean, early matter domination, of course, you cannot get like peaks at high masses, at high sub-halo masses, but because just it's early. So the growth linear, it's like when very little stuff is inside the horizon. But
yeah,
like in principle, you can also look for the stuff with sub-halos that are much more massive, no? Or it's just the
yeah,
abundance
like,
of the sub-halos is just too small that you don't see it.
Yeah, but like in this model, you're moving the peak to higher masses by lowering the temperature of breathing, so the temperature at which this early stage of matter domination ends, but you cannot lower this. Lower than BBN.
No, just like more generally, right? So there are other models that gives all sorts of stuff that you're gonna get subhalos at say a solar mass, and then.
Yeah. You can go to higher masses. That's not a problem. On the Pulsar timing array side.
Okay.
It's just that the models that we have considered tends to prefer
okay.
a peak to lower masses.
So the signal, so you said, for these masses or benchmark models, the signal is dominated by the Earth term, as I understood, yeah? So this Earth term is a kind of noise also, right? Because you said it's stochastic, there are multiple events. So is it true that you are just looking for some specific type of noise in the pulsar timing signals?
Yeah, so we expect the like for the Earth time we are really looking at the two-point function.
Mm-hmm.
So the expectation is the two-point function of the signal has a different shape than the two-point function of the noise. But you're right. So the signal will look like a kind of noise, and we are trying to leverage the fact that the statistical properties of this dark matter noise is different are different than the statistical properties of the background noise that you have in the experiment.
I see. Yeah.
So
what kind of what kind of noise is it? Is it red noise, blue noise, white? What is that actually?
I think that realistically you have both white and red noise. In this analysis, we are only considering the white noise.
Your the signal.
The signal. Yeah, the signal. It's I wouldn't call it white or red noise. We are computing. So the filter that we are using in the analysis is compute numerically. So we generate multiple realizations of this dark matter sub-halo population, and we compute a template of two-point functions, and we compute the average two-point function, and then we use that as a filter. I wouldn't know.
So I don't know if you have any pictures of that, but what is that? It's kind of a bump.
Yeah,
somewhere?
I don't have any picture, but it's peak at 1/1 the typical time scale of the transition time of the dark matter sub-halos. Unfortunately, I don't think I have any picture.
Okay.
The angular correlation, I guess, what will be like a dipole or something?
Yeah, there is an angular correlation. I don't think it's a dipole. It's just related by the position of the pulsars in the sky. So.
Right. But it's distinct from like the normal like Hellingsdown quadrupole, right? Because you're not looking for why is it not a dipole? Because the Earth is just moving, you're saying, due to some subhalos,
yeah.
And so therefore everything then responds to that the Earth. And then if the Earth is going in some direction, I would think that would make like something like a dipole. You know, you're saying that is not what happens.
It's just the angular factor, which is given by the vector we connect the Earth to the pulsar. So it's just a bunch of angular factors which are given by the scalar product of this vector connecting the Earth to the pulsar and the gravitational potential that is inducing the acceleration.
Yeah, that's
so you
right.
can compute.
Yeah, that's right. So is that not a dipole? I mean, right, because it's like a vector dotted into some constant vector, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it has a dipole. It must have a dipole inside. Yeah, it may have higher harmonics as well.
Yeah.
Right? It may not be pure dipole, but probably it is dominated by dipole, isn't it?
I think you're right. Yeah. Should be a dipole. Might be wrong, but yeah, I think you're right.
So I had a different question. So if you go back to your sensitivity plot, like it seemed that you were sensitive down to these like 10 to the minus 12 subhalo masses.
Yeah. Wait a second. Okay.
Right, something like this. So does this mean, you're also saying that at these, for these masses, the Earth signal dominates. So does that mean that therefore these PTAs will see like all of the near Earth asteroids as a guaranteed signal?
I would expect that signal to be much, much lower, right? So the density of the asteroids is expected to be lower than the density of these dark matter subhalos.
Like the number density, you mean?
Yeah, the number density.
So you're saying that there's more mass in dark matter than there is mass in asteroids interior to the Earth?
Yeah. Yeah. And
can I ask, maybe you talked about it and I missed it. Sorry to interrupt the thought, but it's related to what Neil. What is the characteristic impact parameter? Does it mean the Earth is inside the halo when essentially?
That depends on the typical mass of the halos and the concentration parameter. But you can have cases in which the impact parameter is smaller than the radius of the halo, and you're within the halo.
Characteristic like for 10 to the minus 12 solar masses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's say for that, what is the impact parameter for those? How does it scale with, I mean, yeah, so can you say a bit more than that for just pick a mass? And tell us a bit more, like more detailed things about it. Let's say all the dark matter was in 10 to minus 12 solar mass halos with some concentration parameter. What is the impact parameter to the Earth and things like that? And
I think I can show you a plot. I don't have the backup slide, but I can show. Use this. Your plot.
But your slide, I thought, actually gave the number density, didn't it? I mean, so that should be all we need, right? Because we know the volume inside the Earth's radius, right?
Yeah, but I don't have a plot of the value of the impact parameter in terms of the mass. I want to show that thing. Gives a bit more information. So this is so B mean is the minimum. I mean, the smallest impact parameter that you expect on average for different values of the dark matter halo, and for different values of the concentration parameter.
Yeah. Sorry. So, the size of the Earth-Sun orbit is 10 to minus 7 parsecs.
10 minus 5.
10 minus 5. Okay, so these are closer to the... Is 10 minus 5 in parsec, the Earth sun?
Yeah, so 1 AU is 200,000 parsec. I mean, 200,000 AU is 1 parsec.
So that means for 10 to the minus 12, the impact parameter is about that.
Yeah, like 1 AU.
But what is the typical size of the object? RS is larger than that, right?
Yeah. This is, I mean, you can see this in the same plot, right? So RS is larger than the impact parameter up to masses of roughly 10 to the minus 4 solar masses.
Yeah, so that means that how big is the solar system? So does this mean that this is as big as the solar system? And it's going through the solar system roughly?
Yeah, if you're, I mean, depends on the mass, but you can have large objects, yes. But this is
a massive, like 10 to the minus 12. Like the RS curve is like a factor of 10 above the beam in curve, looks like.
So isn't it disrupted by the solar system?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I was going to ask.
Like, but presumably this is like the first near encounter this subhalo has had, right?
Yeah, if it's a first near encounter, then it may be okay, actually, because these things are much denser than the disk, than the star density in the disk. They have to be denser than that already.
What do you mean to be completely disrupted? There have been simulations, right, of the local abundance of dark matter subhalos. And you can study the abundance for different, changing the distance from the center of the solar system.
Of course. Your impact parameter, is very small compared to RS. The whole thing is disrupted after this encounter.
Yeah, it's not there anymore. It's going through and then it disappears.
Yeah, but presumably you're focusing on the case where this is like the very first such encounter this object had. So therefore, it hasn't yet had time to be disrupted by the sun.
Yeah, we are not making any assumption on that, but I think that, realistically, that is going to be the first encounter.
Now, question, I'm still confused because one of the big, there is gravitational noise in nanograv from the solar system. So here, most of the mass is in a radius, outside of, so the question is it's a different thing to look for a gravitational wave signature in the nanograv data than to look for this type of signature. So the question is, why doesn't the local gravitational perturbations, for example, there is the famous systematic that they identify from the motion of Jupiter in their data recently, right? So the question is, these are not the same for this type of signature. In fact, they could be quite similar because of the stochastic nature. It's not an overall signal across the sky. Here you correlate timing. There's a specific correlation for gravitational waves. Here, that's not the case. So then how do you reject those systematics?
Yeah, that's a good point. We are trying to understand that. This analysis does not include all the full systematic of nanograv. So this is kind of an initial analysis. We are still working through the old systematic of nanograv, so cannot tell you exactly how. So which is the one that you are worried about mostly?
Just everything, like the solar, I don't know what exactly it looks like, but for example, in nanograv, they have to remove the motion of Jupiter, for example. And that was highly non-trivial. Mm-hmm. There were timing problems. So there are objects in the solar system, especially given that your mass is so low, and most of it will be outside the impact parameter actually probes a fraction of this mass, right? So the question is how, I mean, and you're talking about kick. It's not a quadruple. I mean, for gravitational waves, the analysis in a way has a characteristic correlation because of the shape of the signal. Here you're looking about stochastic kicks. And in a way, I mean, every object does that.
Yeah, but if the two signals are not degenerate, so if they don't have the same shape,
But I don't know what the shape of the systematic is, because the shape, it's not clear that you'll have the same shape of the systematic for the nanograv analysis and this analysis for sure.
Why do you expect the same shape for the systematic of nanograph compared to the kick?
I didn't say that's going to be the same. I'm saying it's going to be different. I just don't know. I'm asking. I mean, I'm asking what happens, because there is a lot of crap in the solar system that we don't see. That's the
bottom. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I think that's again a question about asteroids. Yeah, because things
yeah,
like
exactly.
Like
that's
Jupiter,
the bottom line.
Yeah, of course they have to remove. Yes, so you know, like Jupiter, Uranus, I think they, or even Pluto. I don't know. Pluto probably not, but Uranus they've definitely taken into account. But this is something they model. But yeah, but what about like asteroids that we didn't see? Yeah, so I think that's what Lynn is asking.
Yeah, this is what I'm asking about, essentially.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, we haven't looked into that carefully yet. So we are trying now to see how, I mean, to really implement this pipeline into the full nanograph approach. Which is non-trivial, so I don't think I cannot make quantitative statement as of now in terms of how much these results are going to change when you include all the noise sources. I don't think I can give you full answers to that.
Yeah, and coming back to disruption, I think it's not that obvious. Yeah, so it's true that it's first encounter, but by the time you would expect it to reach closest to the Earth, it may already be partially disrupted, so that may be relevant. You know?
I'm not totally sure, actually, that it's first encounter.
Can I say something? Because sorry, Daniel, to interrupt. Can I answer Sergei's question?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure because I actually think we did. I mean, we worked on the axion clumps paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we did check this. So for things that are dense enough, you will have time. So the tidal deformation of the shape will be, I mean, for, I should be careful in what I'm saying. So we looked at a different mass range for this mm-hmm. thing. We were looking at mass range, which was more relevant for direct detection experiments. But it could be, I think, for a large part of the parameter space, we actually do survive. I mean, there's no way you will come out of the solar system being a club, you are mm-hmm. just gone. But it could, I think there is part of the parameter space, especially I can probably tell you that around 10 minus 15 solar masses and probably 10 minus 14, where the change in the shape, the thing keeps its shape up to high precision while it crosses. And then it just, you get enough velocity kick so that then you get disrupted and things fly away. So you have to run the numbers for these mass parameters, and it's an easy check to do, by the way.
Yes, yeah, but I'm
it's an easy check to do.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. So you see, I mean, just looking at the plot that we see here, yeah. So it should come to the closer to the Earth than its scale radius.
Yeah.
And scale radius is smaller than the size of the solar system. Yes.
Yeah.
So basically, you must be well. This guy must be well inside the solar system. Must be orbiting Sun, essentially.
Yeah. No. The thing is gone. It's just that I think it could still be that it keeps its shape. It's just that these things are. I cannot say it for sure because we didn't look at this mass range specifically. But it's an easy check to do. Like you can calculate. It's a tidal force. You know what? It's a simple back of the envelope estimate to do.
Yep.
Daniel, you were saying, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, no, nothing. I was just saying that I'm not sure it's first encounter, just because it's not the same calculation, of course, but the number intuition that I have is that have bounds, very similar bounds arise. So if you look at bounds on PBHs at 10 to the 13 solar masses, 10 to the 15 solar masses, they are exactly coming from the fact that they get captured by stars. So there's the probability for like a PBH to pass through an orbit that gets captured by the star and then just goes around the star, then just hits the star, it's pretty big. So and the bounds from that are at the order of a fraction of PBH of like 10 to the minus 2. So assuming that the capture of this thing, it has the same radius because it has the same mass than the PBH, you're just calculating if it gets captured or not and tidally disrupted perhaps, then I will expect the limit on the fraction of these guys to be also at the order of 10 to the minus 2. That means that if they are all of the dark matter, they had 100 encounters within the age of the galaxy. Now, this is all very sloppy, right? Because it's not the same for PBHs than for subhalos, but...
You can do it. I mean, you can do the estimates. Yeah. Right. So you can do the estimate, assuming that you cross the stars. I mean, it's an easy estimate to do all of the stars.
Exactly. And I think that the answer is that you get 100 encounters per galaxy. So that's per galaxy age.
Yeah. 100 crossings.
Yes,
you mean from
think,
the disk.
I think.
From the disk, but that's not the same as crossing the solar system, right? Because the solar system is a much closer impact parameter. And actually, I have a question for you. Because you go to very light masses, what is the probability that it goes within this impact parameter from the Earth? Have you estimated event rate? Because you're dominated by the Earth. What, I mean... These are very, I mean.
Sorry, what is the probability that?
No, no, what is the event rate? How often does the thing cross the solar system?
I mean, the time scale of the cross is given by.
I'm asking a slightly different question. I'm asking how often does it cross the solar system? Not how long does it take to cross the solar system? What is the incident? How many of these do you expect to have near the Earth at all?
I mean, you can just compute the number density, right? For mass interval.
Yeah, I agree. And I remember for this mass scale, because we did the similar, for these low masses, you're getting very, very, very low event rates.
So you had the plot before showing the number density, right, on your slide.
Yeah, I was trying to... Number. Put it back. Yeah.
So you're. This is 10 to the 12th per cubic parsec. It looks like. Or I need to make your window bigger. Or 10 to the 9 per cubic parsec. And so an AU is 1. Is 10 to the minus 5. Let's say of a parsec. And so we cube that to get 10 to the minus 15.
Yes.
So instantaneously, we have of order 10 to the minus 6 inside of the Earth.
And that has to be multiplied with 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light, right? Because it's like, because the 10 to minus 3 is one, yeah, but how often do they cross?
Right. So what's the time scale, I guess, to cross? So they're moving at 200 kilometers a second, I guess, right? So an AU, the Earth is an AU, so it's 200 million kilometers. So 200 million kilometers divided by 200 kilometers per second is, a million seconds.
Yeah, that's like a month. That's the crossing time.
Exactly, right. Yeah, exactly.
But
so
that's not the incidence time, right?
The rate is therefore the number instantaneously divided by that time scale, right?
Yeah, okay.
And so that number instantaneously we said was like 10 to the minus 6. And then divided by the time scale of like a month. So it takes, I guess, 10 to the 6 months.
Yeah, for one to cross. So then why? I mean, yeah, that sounds... Yeah, this is what I remember too, that these were very long time scales. So where is the signal coming from here? Are you assuming there is something on the solar system and then taking the analysis. So are you assuming the clump is already there? Are you taking the rates into account?
I mean, we are generating just a homogeneous distribution of clumps in a volume which is given by the observation time times the velocity of that matter. So we are taking a volume of simulation which is given by velocity, so 200 kilometers per second times the observation times, which is order of tens of years. We generate the halos randomly, but in an homogeneous way, and then we let them evolve and we compute the signal. So the only assumption that we make is that the local density of dark matter is the one that we know. And then we let the halo evolve. We don't make any assumption on, I mean, we are not generating the halo already close to the solar system.
But they're moving,
already
right?
Close to the
they're just moving.
Yeah, they are moving. Yeah, we generate the velocity again, stochastically, but following a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of the dark matter, and we let them evolve. We don't make any assumption about, I mean, we don't place them in a way that we generate a signal.
So the time scale for one encounter should be that 20 years, right? Like if you get one, you see it.
Yeah.
I
remember
by the
number.
Way, sorry, let me maybe thank Andrea again and stop the recording here so we can also let Josh go. Thank you, Andrea.